Welcome to Ideas for the Future of Vermont, a podcast produced by GNAT TV and the Vermont Council on Rural Development.
Hello and welcome back to part 9 of a 10-part series GNAT TV and other community access centers across the Vermont Access Network are hosting in partnership with the Vermont Council on Rural Development and the Barry Montpelier Times Argus and Rutland Herald newspapers. I'm Andrew McKeever, the news director at GNAT TV's news project, and it's a pleasure to have you with us today. This 10-part series is about ideas for the future of Vermont and looks at some of the ways or big questions facing the state as we emerge out of the pandemic and into whatever lies ahead. What are some of the big issues that are facing the state in coming years, and how will we go about tackling them? We've been through 9 topics so far, or 8, I should say. Today is our 9th. We will have one more on civic engagement coming up next week, so we'll hope you'll return to hear that one as well. So far, some of the topics that we've discussed on this series include broadband development, welcoming new Vermonters, climate change and its relationship to the state's economy, and localizing food and energy. If you missed one of them and want to perhaps get caught up on some of these previous discussions, you can visit the website futureofvermont.org/explore, and you'll find there not only the previous telecasts, but also the written opinion pieces that have been published in the Herald and the Times Argus that have gone along with this series, and also podcast versions of our shows, in case you'd just rather listen to them. Today, our topic is about working lands and the environment, and specifically, the 9th proposition in the series reads, Vermont must protect our lands and waters and advance the economy of the working landscape. So with us today to discuss this point are Paul Costello, who is the Executive Director of the Vermont Council on Rural Development. Andy Keeler is the President of Jasper Hill Farm in Greensboro, Vermont. And Charlie Hancock is the President of Forestry at Northwoods Resource Group in Montgomery. Gentlemen, thank you all for making the time for this discussion today. Great to have you all with us.
Thank you, Andrew.
Good to be here.
Thanks for having me.
Paul, I was wondering if perhaps you could get us started by giving us a bit of an overview of this proposition and how did it become one of the 10 propositions and make that short list?
Well, thanks so much. And thanks for having us again, Andrew, and all your leadership in putting these shows together. It's been great working with you and GNAT. So food is just foundational for all of us, right? And when you talk about resilience for the long-term future, the land is the foundation of our resilience. It's the foundation of our lifestyle, and it's central to what we most love about Vermont. There's long roots to this conversation in Vermont. The Council on the Future of Vermont 12 years ago that sort of pre-visioned some of this proposition work did an analysis of public values in Vermont and public priorities for the future. And we listened to thousands of people, and then we polled people on what we had heard as values statement. And the highest ranking value back in 2009 when we did this was the value of the working landscape and its heritage as a defining feature of what we most love about Vermont. It had more than 98% of Vermonters in agreement that that was central to who we are as a people. And for us, that's incredibly, you know, it's an incredible statement of public interest in this topic. But we know it's challenged. We've seen over the last generation tremendous loss of dairy farms. When I started in this position, we had basically 3 times as many dairy farms in Vermont as we do now. We had more than twice as many mills in the forest products industry. We had a pulpwood market connected to Maine and New Hampshire. And the entirety of that, that fundamental industry has been challenged. When you think about the working lands that we have, the beauty of the Vermont landscape, we have we have our designated wilderness areas and we have national forest, but 80% of Vermont is forested, or 78% now. Charlie can correct me on this. And 80% of that is privately owned. The rest of the land is kept open, a great part of it, in agriculture. And that mix of farms and fields and forests is like essential to the definition of our view of what Vermont is. But all that land is part of an economy. Nobody keeps their land open just because they can. They keep it open as part of an economy that sustains it, just as foresters keep their land in forest for long-term production because there's an economic return. If that return on either side is gone, then you're going to see alternative uses that the marketplace is pushing already to use agricultural and forest lands for housing, for strip development, and so forth. And so as a state, we have strong planning principles that have worked to encourage the foundational economies on both sides that have kept the land in production and stewarded in pretty good part those lands for the last generations. But when we come into, and we see the problems that we already have in the center of the agri economy with dairy and the center of the forest products industry, and then you see the challenges to our supply lines when something comes like COVID, where we don't have a lot of food in the state. We've seen great progress in the purchase of local foods. We've seen great progress in diversification of Vermont agriculture. But we're still see empty store shelves after a week of pandemic. You know, the toilet paper's gone, but pretty soon the meat's looking pretty scarce too. And having a resilient food system that that provides for our well-being in tough times is crucial. We're in a national setting with climate change coming, where we need to be sequestering carbon, drawing it down out of the atmosphere. Our forests are the best way to do that. Agricultural lands are another great way to do that. We also are looking at resilience in terms of food fiber in the face of climate change and how we build a sustainable economy and sustainable living for Vermonters in the future. So some pretty big questions ahead of us. And this comes in centrally. When we did the Council on the Future of Vermont and Working Lands work after that with Andy Keeler and others, we did a 40-year analysis of public policy around working lands in Vermont. And fundamental to the findings of that was the fact that forever, when people have looked at agriculture and forestry in Vermont, they've said, you can't compete for the bottom of an international commodity economy. That if you're just competing for the New England or global milk market or powdered milk market as your prime area, or for the raw log that's shipped internationally, you're losing the top end value for the productive commodity. You're not making toys in bowls, you're not making furniture, and you're not making great cheese like Jasper Hill does that returns dollars to Vermont and can support people with a strong quality of life so that they can raise their children in our small communities. So we believe that we need to invest in diversification and value-added development to build the most creative forest products industry, creative agricultural industry in Vermont's history. But we also know that we do it because of the creativity of the farmers and foresters who've come before, that we have this land because of the sweat equity, the risks, the families dedicated to the land for generations of Vermont. And we want to welcome new families to Vermont into that circle. And this is foundational to the future of Vermont.
All right. Well, Annie, Charlie, let's have you tell us a little bit about your respective businesses here. And Andy, if I may, let me start with you. Tell us the story about the growth of your Jasper Hill Farm. I understand you started back, I think, in 1998 and bought a former farm, and you've sort of taken it to several new levels. What's the story?
Absolutely. Thanks again for having me on your show. I look forward to participating in this conversation because it's foundational to what we do at Jasper Hill. The reason Mateo, my brother, and I bought the farm was that in 1997, 1998, Greensboro lost 30% of its dairy farms. And it was a palpable blow to our community. At the time, two of the three select board members for Greensboro were dairy farmers. dairy farming is like the heart of our community and the heart of our sort of community character. And I was a carpenter at the time. Both Mateo and I were carpenters at the time. And we started visioning on what our community would look like without dairy farms. And there's a lot of rocky top land here that's not really suitable for cultivation. And in 1998, we purchased this this farm, and it took us a few years to figure out exactly what we wanted to do. And in 2003, we started Jasper Hill Farm, and we started producing Farmstead raw milk cheeses on our farm. And we started with 15 heifers that we purchased from Canada. And our goal was to create an economic model that would allow for financial stability and long-term viability for a Rocky Top Vermont Hill farm, dairy farm. Our sort of economic standard was to be able to put away enough money to put our kids through college and to be able to support a multi-generational income in order to facilitate the transition of a dairy farm. After a few years, we'd never farmed before, right? When we got into farming, I'd never milked a cow before. We approached 7 banks, and nobody would lend us money because we didn't have any experience in agriculture, and nobody really thought we knew what we were getting into. And it was a really risky proposition to lend us money to start a dairy farm when farms were going out left and right. By 2006, 2007, we pretty much came to the realization that what we were doing was going to be very hard to replicate, because you have to be a biochemist, you have to know finance, you have to know animal husbandry, you have to know how to sell something, right? And we had a hard time seeing how you're going to have 20 or 30 farmstead cheesemakers dotting the countryside here in Greensboro if everyone has to do every part of the supply chain. And that's how the sellers were born. We built about 22,000 square foot facility that's mostly underground to age and package cheese and sell cheese. And we now partner with 5 other cheesemakers, including Cabot Cooperative Creamery, to age, market, and sell their cheese. And the idea is, if you could reduce some of the barriers to entry, we found that 50% of all the labor at Jasper Hill Farm was not in milking cows or turning that milk into cheese. It was taking care of the inventory that piled up after the cheese was produced, right? And the capital expense that's involved in building an aging facility is substantial. And so we thought if you could reduce those barriers by taking advantage of an economy of scale where it makes sense to take care of that, which is in turning cheese, wrapping cheese, packaging cheese, shipping cheese, and allow dairy farmers to make really high quality milk and cheesemakers to turn that high quality milk into high quality cheese, we'd be able to develop a local economy that exists outside of the commodity milk market, right? And that's the goal for Jasper Hill, is it's our response to globalization. How can you operate a dairy farm outside of the commodity milk markets? And that's what we're up to. We are just getting to kind of Jasper Hill 2.0. We're in the middle of a fairly sizable expansion of our creamery here and working on building a new aging facility as well down in Hardwick. So,
wow, amazing. My hat goes off to you. That is like so far beyond anything I would have been capable of doing. Well, Charlie, let's turn to you. How did you get into forestry consulting at the Northwoods Resource Group? I'm envious there too, since you get to play in the woods every day.
Yeah.
It's unfair.
Yeah, I can bring my dog to work every day too, which is great for him. yeah, thanks for the opportunity and thanks for having us today. So I went to school for environmental studies at UVM, and I got there, and after one semester, I realized that I could spend the next 4 years out in the woods and come out with a degree that I could apply to something, and that just captured my imagination. And I had the opportunity, after working in the Adirondacks for a larger timber investment company, to come back to Vermont and practice forestry on the Vermont scale. You know, as Paul said, you know, 80% of our landscape is owned by private landowners. Most of those parcels are somewhere between, you know, 75 to 200 acres. And these are the folks that basically that own this resource that we look at, but we kind of take for granted. And one that is just foundational to every single thing that we do and talk about as a state, whether it's economic development, climate change, water quality, economic growth. I mean, it's all based in these things that are backbones, our forests, our working lands. And so in my day job, I work with private landowners and nonprofits across the northern tier of the state. At one level, just kind of helping them figure out, you know, it's kind of clinical to say, what are your objectives? Typically, we frame it more as, what do you love about this place? What spins your wheels? What are your hopes and dreams? And from that, we kind of tease out, what can we do to help you manage your land to meet those goals, whether they're around timber investment or wildlife habitat, or getting into areas of carbon sequestration now. So we kind of work as partners to these landowners. And I say partners because we really do see them as partners in our work. When we scale back from just kind of meeting these kind of near-term objectives of what we might want from our woods, the bigger picture that we work in is opening these landowners' eyes up to where their place is within this broader northern forest that extends all the way from the Adirondacks up to the Gaspé Peninsula, out to Maine, and across to New York. You know, this is the largest temperate broadleaf forest left anywhere in the world. From an ecological perspective, it's incredibly important. From an economic perspective, it's incredibly important. And they, as landowners, as small as they might be, are the critical linchpins to this whole endeavor. And so getting them to understand kind of where they sit within this broader context, both in an ecological sense, but also in an economic sense, it helps recruit them as partners in this work and as advocates for what we're doing. And it also, to some degree, helps reestablish some of the connections that we're losing. As Paul said, you know, we're losing sawmills and dairy farms at a pace which is crazy to think about. I was talking with someone this morning, and we were just walking through the woods, ticking off the mills that are no longer here. And these aren't mills that were here 50 years ago. These were mills that were here 3 years ago, 5 years ago, 10 years ago. And, you know, we were figuring out that we were averaging about 1.5 sawmills per year over the last decade that disappeared. And when that happens, we lose a connection to the land, not just in the landowners, but in the communities that we work in. A mile up the road from where I'm sitting, there used to be a bobbin mill that employed close to 400 people and sent bobbins all across New England. If you go the other direction, 2 miles, there used to be a mill that made boxes. And if you had bought a Victrola record player anywhere in the world back around the beginning part of the last century, it would have come in a box that was stamped Atlas Plywood Company, Montgomery, Vermont. And there was a gentleman in town who passed away about 3 years ago, who was the last person I knew who remembered the mill. He used to tell stories of going as a kid to hang out with the mill workers at lunchtime. And it was just great. You know, that was our heritage in these places, and we're losing it, you know? And when we lose that connection, we lose that commitment and that lens that we see all of this work through. So, you know, I think a big part of what I do is working with landowners to meet their objectives, both from an ecological perspective as well as an economic one. You know, ensuring that these lands, both our farms and our forests, are economically viable is a big step of keeping them as those working lands and not seeing them fall to subdivision development. You know, for the first time since, you know, the great rebound of reforestation in Vermont, we're losing forests for the first time, starting, you know, within the last decade or so. That's happening on our watch, and it's something that we need to address. And so economic viability is a huge part of it. There's other tools there, but keeping our working lands economically viable for the organizations and people that are working them is what's going to keep them as those working lands with that whole myriad of values that they provide. So, you know, our work, we see it being at the granular scale of the acre and at the macro scale of where we sit in this entire northern forest and everything that it means to us and, you know, the place we call home.
I want to ask you both what you see as the major challenges you see going forward around protecting lands and sort of reversing the trends you both have talked about here with agriculture and forestry and forest services. But Charlie, I want to ask you if you could build on the point you were just making there, because again, I was online earlier and ran across a comment you'd made on a website. Let's see, Strategic Initiatives. You said the biggest problem you saw was fragmentation, that smaller and smaller parcels with the multiple owners make it harder to manage the forest. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that as to how you see that either being stabilized or fixed or reversed, whatever the right solution may be, in your opinion, in order to make sure that forest lands are protected and are taken care of.
Yeah. So just, I guess, first, as far as fragmentation, what are we talking about? You know, fragmentation is the general idea that we have large blocks of contiguous forest land in the state. You know, some of our largest ones are upwards of 90,000 acres. And these blocks are critical to all of the functions that we care about, whether it's the economic value of production or the values for water quality, wildlife habitat, carbon sequestration, all the things we think about as being important. And fragmentation is what occurs essentially when you have those blocks broken up by things like development, roads, land conversion, having forests change from being forests. When that happens, the associated values of that area, whether it's from a wildlife habitat perspective, productivity perspective, they get diminished. Right? Strictly from an economic perspective, if you have a 100-acre parcel that's chopped up into 10-acre parcels, it makes it a lot less viable to actually practice active management. You lose the economy of scale of harvesting timber in that kind of way. So it hits all the points, whether it's economic, ecological. So our work is, you know, essentially in keeping forests as forests and keeping them intact. Now, there's multiple ways we can go about doing that. You know, conservation easements are a huge tool, you know, ensuring that perpetually those lands will remain intact as working lands with some degree of supervision of management detailed in the easement. Those are incredibly, incredibly important. But as we were just talking about, maintaining the economic viability of those lands is also critically important. If you have a landowner, whether it's a sawmill that owns 500 acres or a family who's passed it down from generation to generation to generation, if those families or entities can't afford to cover the carrying costs of the property, pay the taxes, let alone make any money, that property is not going to stay as forest. It's going to be moved to a different use. We're going to see land conversion, and a lot of land conversion which might not be reversible. You know, a lot of the reforestation that we saw in the last century was essentially ag land growing back up to trees. Our state is incredibly resilient from that perspective. If we see subdivision, development, and sprawl happening in the landscape, you know, those don't revert back to working forests. You might think about the pictures you see from places like, you know, Chernobyl or something, where you've got trees growing up out of what used to be a parking lot. That happens, but they're not the kind of forests we want. And so ensuring that our forests remain economically viable, you know, with all working lands is a huge key to keeping them as those economic and ecological engines that we look to them for.
And Andy, over to you. What do you see as the main challenge confronting Vermont agriculture? I'm assuming part of the solution you see to the shrinking number of dairy farms around the state and farms in general, perhaps, is to upgrade the brand, if you will, of Vermont agriculture and the products that you and your colleagues make. Is there a way forward you're seeing for that to happen and sort of, you know, bring more vitality and strength to the agricultural sector?
It is an enormous challenge, but I'm really hopeful. Just to echo, the same sort of challenges apply to agriculture, and that once an agricultural parcel is divided up, it's really hard to put Humpty Dumpty back together again and retain like the agricultural integrity of a parcel once it's subdivided. As far as what does the future look like? What we do is, I don't think, is like a silver bullet that all of a sudden it's going to be an answer for all of Vermont's dairy farms. There are some complicated problems to overcome as far as milk procurement, right? So a small cheesemaker is going to have a hard time being able to purchase the entirety of a farm's milk supply in order to get started, right? And so some of the rules and regulations around like milk procurement make it really hard for a small cheesemaker to secure a milk supply. Typically, dairy farms are locked into a contract with like a single customer, one of the co-ops. And to get started, you have to build a market. And that's hard to do when you're having to purchase the entirety of somebody's milk supply. I see an opportunity to build like a value-added milk supply that's not intended for like commodity production, but intended for like artisan, high quality artisan production. But there's some like systematic structural problems that need to be addressed in order to be able to achieve some of these ideas. Yeah. Ultimately, what I'm most hopeful about is that I think that as a society, we're headed to the place where people are willing to pay for what it costs to produce some of these products. And in a lot of cases, industrial production sort of buries some of the costs of climate change, of health, of in their products that society as a whole ends up having to pay for, right? So agriculture is really at the center of society's greatest challenges right now, as far as being the largest user of energy, the largest user of land, the largest user of like water, one of the largest polluters. There's some real challenges to overcome. And the hopeful part of it is that agriculture can be part of the solution to these problems. And looking forward to some of the biggest challenges that we as a society are going to face are long-term medical problems like diabetes. And our diet and the way we relate to food and farming is kind of at the center of some of these long-term systemic, like social issues. And farming needs to be part of the solution. And, you know, when the pandemic hit, we lost 45% of our sales within a couple of weeks. It was kind of devastating. We ended up having a better year than we had budgeted for because there is a huge part of our population that's willing to support the small family farm and products that they can relate to, and they can see the benefits that it has to the communities that they're a part of, right? So 56 cents of every dollar that we spend within 15 miles of Jasper Hill, right? So you talk about like the economics of farming, and it's different from your typical manufacturer. The number of times that those dollars are recycled in our local communities is exponential compared to most like manufacturing. And so I think the last time I did this was in 2019, but from 2003 to 2019, we spent about $60 million within 15 miles of Jasper Hill, right? And that's like, that's transformative, right? And you look at the condition of the general store in our Greensboro 10 years ago compared to what it is now, and you can see like the difference that that we're having in our local community. So I'm very hopeful, only because things have to change. Our experience is that people are willing to pay for a product that tastes great, that they can, that's authentic, that is part of a local landscape, and that's how we sell our product, right? We engage our customers as co-creators of an economy in our local community here.
You mentioned the impact of the pandemic on your business there, Andy. But I wanted to kind of ask you both, coming out of the pandemic, one of the concerns that was expressed a lot was about long supply chains, a lot of stuff coming from China or elsewhere around the world, taking a long time to get here, you know, and it would be really good to see more of those sorts of things manufactured or created here more locally, or certainly within the United States. Do you think those concerns about long supply chains will be possible to kind of leverage that into sort of boosting state support for farming and forestry in order to kind of, you know, help, you know, folks like you out and, you know, kind of just sort of improve the situation so that we don't get stuck in that kind of situation again, should there be another crisis like a pandemic or worse? And Charlie, perhaps I'll throw this one to you first, if I may.
Yeah, thanks. I think re-envisioning the supply chain is going to be critical to figure out kind of how do we catalyze the opportunities that we have here in the state to focus growth in the places we want it, and essentially keep the money local. You know, as Paul alluded to, we work in these markets which are essentially global commodity markets, right? Half the timber I cut here goes across the international border to Canada. Things get shipped to China. You know, I mean, so when we don't have control over our price, we don't have control over our future. And so a big part of controlling your price is having a handle on the supply chain and how we can kind of find those bottlenecks, find those pinch points and tweak them in a way that essentially strengthens that local Vermont-based, or in some cases, regional-based economy, right? You know, I think of the wood products economy, ag's the same way to some degree. You know, it's not just Vermont, it's Vermont, New Hampshire, Massachusetts. So I think thinking kind of locally, regionally, and how we context that is important. But I think the main kind of thing, at least to me, when we think about the supply chain, is what is the role of public policy here and public investment? A lot of the things that we would need to change about our supply chains are not things that I can change or Andy can change, at least not easily. These are things where public investments are going to be just not just critical, but like it won't happen without them. You know, and there's a entity that was established that came out of the work that Paul referenced, this the future of Vermont kind of work back in 2010, 11. An entity that came out of that was the Working Lands Enterprise Initiative, Working Lands Enterprise Fund, which is administered by a board, which I sit on. And one of our big, you know, pieces of work is looking at supply chains and figuring out where are the bottlenecks, where are the pinch points, where are things where states, public entities can direct resources to catalyze growth that will not just, you know, support the sawmills or help boost, you know, cheese production, but that are going to make our rural communities whole. You know, and I just want to hammer that home that like it's not just about these sectors, it's about rural communities, rural economic development, rural livelihoods that we're really talking about here, because it's all connected back to it. And so, you know, the Working Lands Enterprise Initiative since 2012, it's distributed close to like $7 or $8 million in grants and funds to enterprises that work in the ag and forest space. But in doing so, it's leveraged an additional $12 million in investment in areas to really catalyze this growth. And that's where only entities like the state has the capacity to do that. And so we as a state need to really think about what are our priorities and what are we going to fund? This year is a big year due to like ARPA funds and other federal funding. You know, we're looking at like $5.5 million in funding for working lands through this entity. That is an amazing opportunity that we have. Typically, we're looking at maybe a million to 1.5. The flip side of that coin is it's only $5.5 million. And we could spend 10 times that amount of money and still not get to where we need to be. And so I think as a state, we need to really think about where are we investing public dollars? How are we catalyzing those dollars to leverage additional investments? And then how do we basically build the foundation of these rural economies back in a way where we're not sitting here in 10 years talking about demographic changes and rural community drains. We're talking about rural communities' growth, opportunity, and people wanting to live here. So I'll shut up there.
Andrew, I just throw in on this that the Working Lands Enterprise Program came from some work that Andrew Kaler and others put together over the course of 2012 to 14 or so, and then Act 142 that framed the whole initiative that basically we all wrote as a team. But one of the cool things is the way that it has benefited like the orchards in Addison County and meat producers all around the state by making really strategic investments in Champlain orchards, which aggregates apples now and helps other farmers be successful. And places like Black River Produce that became Black River Meats with an investment in productive facilities that opened up opportunities for scores of farmers to convert to beef or pork and open marketplaces for new farms and young people to be able to produce a small number of animals on the side and work towards the development of a farm. And that kind of leverage is really powerful. And we've seen tremendous growth in both the meat industry and in local agriculture in general over the last 8 to 10 years because of these kinds of investments.
And the return, the rate of return, I can't press home enough. Like, and I wish I had this metric in front of me, but like the return for every dollar invested in a dollar of economic growth or job creation and job retention. I mean, I think well over 1,000 jobs that have been created can be attributed to this individual program. That's not just jobs that have been retained, it's jobs that were created. So the multiplier effect that we're seeing from this is just amazing.
I'd say the other side of this is we live in a capitalist society, right? And you'd think a free market economy, but ultimately policy decisions direct capital. And as a society, we need to make decisions around how we want to incentivize that direction of capital. And we like to say that who we're competing against isn't our colleagues here in the United States. It's where we're competing against industrial production coming from Europe. And they have different policy decisions. For example, when COVID hit in France, they directed a 40% tax credit to any investment, capital investments in cheese production, right? So we're in the middle of building a new facility and we're competing against cheesemakers who are upgrading their facilities and the government is paying for 40% of it, right? They subsidize their farmers over there, but they subsidize not just production, right? They'll subsidize the environmental contributions that those farms provide to their communities. So as a society, we have the opportunity here to rethink what our priorities are and develop policy to direct capital into the areas that we find high priorities. And I would argue that the working lands, 98% of Vermonters agree that it's really important. So current use is an excellent example of a policy that has allowed farms to stay together, reduction in the fragmentation of our forests, and is responsible in a large part for what we get to participate and enjoy when we drive up and down the interstate, right? So there's an opportunity here to rethink how, like, what our priorities here and what we as a society are willing to invest in.
Do you see the legislature being responsive to that or sort of getting it when you lay that out for them there? Are they going, yeah, you're right, you know, we need to put more money into the Department of Agriculture to help you folks out, or into forestry and land use.
Is it a tax credit? Right? Is it a tax credit that maybe you don't have to fund the Agency of Agriculture for, but that somebody who has plenty of money is going to be willing to invest in a certain segment of our economy?
Yeah.
So I don't have all the answers. It's complicated. And, you know, we've faced budget shortages over the last several fiscal cycles, and it's hard to be able to pay for everything that we want to pay for. And it's easy to get into a conversation around, do we fund like fuel assistance for people who can't afford it, or do we fund the working landscape? And it's a really hard conversation to have.
Yeah.
And I don't want to belittle the enormity of the situation that the legislature has to undertake every year. But as far as priorities go, I think Paul hit it on the head. It's the thing that resonates the most when people are asked.
Yeah. And it's going to take ingenuity, right? And we've seen this work in the past. I mean, you look at the Vermont Housing and Conservation Board. That's something that when you talk to folks elsewhere in the country about it, they look at you like, you did what? How does that work? But it's been something that has been like a flagship program for Vermont in this area. And it's catalyzed growth and development in ways that probably never thought possible using a tool that no one had ever considered before. And so I think some of the tools that we need to kind of get to, they might not be in our portfolio yet, but we can develop them if we just kind of utilize that kind of ingenuity. And I think another thing that is a challenge is the legislature has a lot on their plate, no doubt. And I think one of our jobs when we talk to them is to kind of help them make the connections as to why this is important for this. So for example, like we're talking about the working lands economy. A municipal wastewater system for Greensboro or Montgomery probably isn't in that framework for a legislator. But when we look at the fact that affordable housing isn't available in Montgomery Center or in parts of Greensboro because there's no municipal wastewater system, so those kind of smaller lots that can't redevelop alternatives, can't be sold to lower income people because banks won't lend to them, blah, 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 blah. We see that all these things are tied together. And so those kind of critical infrastructure investments, which might not have any connection to a farm or a forest, really do have a critical connection. And so one of our jobs is to kind of help the legislature see those connections and realize that when you're investing over here, you're going to see an impact over here. And that's one of those things with the working landscape that the more you pull on a string, who was it? One of the great conservation leaders, you pull on a string and you find it's connected to everything else. And that is no more so true than the working landscape in Vermont and New England.
Let me ask you both what I'm sure to some is the 800-pound gorilla in the room, and that's climate change. And it's going to have a big impact from all reports I've read anyway. What do we need to do to kind of get ready for, with temperatures rising even more dramatically than they already have? We've heard an awful lot about how we need to electrify vehicles and, reduce the amount of carbon emissions. I mean, how does that play into both the forestry and the farming sectors? Land use, it seems to be about as basic as it gets when it comes to the impact of climate change. And Andy, I'll let you start on that one.
Well, I think right now, and at least I'll just speak for dairy farming, the incentive is to get big. It's impossible to get ahead as a small scale dairy farmer that's selling into this global market. The larger you get, the more likely you are to till soil, and the harder it's going to be to employ some of the regenerative agricultural practices that can be at the heart of soil, of carbon sequestration and farming, like rotational grazing. So I think if we can help fix some of the economics around around farming and maybe change some of the ways that we incentivize production, we can consider having more an incentive to move towards more regenerative, like agricultural practices.
Yeah. I mean, speaking from a forest standpoint, you know, the best carbon capture technology we have available to us is a tree. You know, I don't care what Elon Musk has got brewing or whoever else. I mean, like trees, it's basic, but they're amazing. And so when we think about, you know, climate change and what Vermont's role in is in kind of, you know, looking forward to build resilience, adaptation, you know, meeting our metrics that are in the Global Warming Solutions Act for 2030, 2050. At the key from a forest standpoint is keeping forests as forests and reversing that trend of forest loss. Now, within that, we can have a whole bunch of discussions around, you know, what's better, wilderness, working lands. But I think diving into those details kind of loses that kind of bigger picture that is keeping forests as forests, or increasing forests is kind of the key there. And that idea of that degree of management that we're going to see where we're sequestering and restoring carbon over time. So the kind of management we practice is important. But it plays into everything else, right? We could just say, no, we're not going to cut anything ever again, and our forests are just going to store carbon. That'd be great. We could also say we're going to plant every single agricultural field out there in trees. That would solve the problem, right? But we'd have no food. So there's no quick solution. And again, everything's tied to everything else. And so it's a case of keeping forests as forests. But to do that, we need to strengthen the working lands economy. We need to make sure that maintaining and owning them is economically viable. We need to look at those systems approaches for natural climate solutions, right? We can grow a tree in a forest. We can store carbon. But we can also take that tree and put it in an embodied carbon wood product, mass timber, things that could be produced locally from a regional perspective, you know, that keep that carbon capture, that replace steel. And so it's not just this one little piece here or one little piece there. It's coming up with this systems approach to understand that it's across the entire value chain that we can have an impact in that. And so I think that a big part of that is kind of wrapping our heads around that big picture and then teasing out kind of what are the steps we have to take? What are the public investments we have to make? What are the public policies we have to have in place to ensure that we can hit those benchmarks?
We just have a couple of minutes left for one last question. I wanted to ask you both, since this came up on the conversation Paul and I were having the other day about this show, you know, one of the ways out, it seems like, is to, since Vermont farmers and wood products folks have a hard time competing on the lower end of the market, but we do have a good opportunity to compete on the higher end. As I think one of you said, rather than sending lumber to Canada that goes to China and comes back as a piece of furniture, you know, maybe we could make our own furniture here, but, you know, sort of higher end stuff. And same perhaps with agriculture, you know, organic farming or whatever. Do you see that as a pathway that might work for Vermont agriculture and forest product folks to kind of shoot for that sort of higher end of the market as a way of competing with larger firms, not only here in the U.S., but around the world?
From agriculture, absolutely. And we're particularly poised to be able to take advantage of that, being in close proximity to a huge population of people up and down the East Coast here, right? So we have a pretty captive audience. Vermont's got an excellent brand that stands for quality. And I think it's a huge opportunity for Vermont agriculture. I think it's our sort of competitive advantage here. We're not going to compete on price in this state.
Yeah, and I think in the wood products sector, it's kind of a case of yes and, right? So we grow some of the highest quality hardwood timber anywhere in the world. You know, the sugar maple, the birch. These are things that are prized, right, for cabinets, flooring, all kinds of things, bowl. I mean, so yeah, we have a place where we can position ourselves in that kind of higher end market and really take advantage of it. But we also grow a lot of not so great wood that has to have a home, right? So I think for the wood product sector, it's both. It's capturing that high end market, you know, leveraging our opportunities there, but also thinking about energy. How can we use biomass in a way where, if used in an efficient generation facility, you know, efficiency is key, in a way that might catalyze district heating opportunities? Can we create, you know, markets for those kinds of things that are not just local, in that we're kind of keeping it local and the money is staying local, but we're also kind of hitting our other objectives around, you know, for example, climate change, moving us off of fossil fuels. So from a wood products perspective, I think it's a yes and. You know, the price of lumber right now is a good example. You know, we're not seeing that same price increase on the stump. We're just not, you know, the sixfold increase in a board. If I went to Sticks and Stuff, I'm not seeing that when I put a load of logs together and ship it to a mill. You know, a lot of our mills haven't been able to take advantage of that increased demand, because a mill can't just say, we're going to increase capacity by 100%. They don't have the ability. They don't have the infrastructure to do that. So if we can increase our sawmill capacity to take advantage of those opportunities like we're seeing right now, oh my God, I can't think of what that would do to our local wood products economy. But we can't. So people are buying that material when it's trucked in from, you name that other place. So it's not just the beautiful wooden bowls or the chips or the boards that we use to, you know, frame our houses. It's all of it put together, trying to figure out how do we think of those systems approaches to keep things local, keep the production local, keep the utilization local. And as Andy said, keep the dollars local.
Well, you answered a question I was going to ask about, you know, well, the lumber prices are going through the roof. It must be great for all these sawmills and forestry product people, because I just went out to buy some lumber for a little garden project a while ago. And I was like, my jaw dropped when they told me what it was. My 2x4s are going to cost me. And I was like, what? Anyway, we're just kind of nearing the end here of our time, but I wanted to give Paul a chance to talk a little bit about the summit meeting that the Vermont Council on Rural Development has planned for us May 26th and 27th. It's going to be a virtual session, Paul, but what's going to be going on?
Well, at this point, there's over 500 people coming. And we expect another 100 or 200 to add in the next week. There's over 100 presenters and facilitators and moderators engaged, including leaders like Charlie and Andy. It's going to be an exciting review of the same propositions we've been talking about on the show. We'll have expert panels, leaders from the legislature, leaders from businesses, nonprofit leaders, sharing perspective on the different propositions on the table on the first day, going one by one through these propositions. And then the second half of the day, this is the 26th of May, next week, there will be deep discussions of those with a group of farmers talking about the working lands proposition, or a group of people of color who've moved to Vermont in the last 5 years, talking about what it's like to be in Vermont and thinking about the propositions as a whole and how they add up and how they could be useful to Vermont. And then the second day, on the 27th, everyone who comes and participates in the summit is going to think together about what do we do to move different elements of these propositions forward? What's most important in these ideas? What are the levers for change? And how do we line up to move them forward? So we call it a summit because it's going to have a major product, which is a partnership and a sense of direction in terms of moving some of these pieces of work forward, sometimes with further convenings to bring organizations and businesses together to drive things home. In other places, it may be nonpartisan, aspirational, positive advocacy to the governor, legislators, and others, but organized and with the consistent push behind it. So we're very excited about the day, and really appreciate this show and all the other shows that you've led, Andrew, to help, you know, get people thinking about the broad issues that we're facing, and think about at this particular time in our history, moving forward together as Vermonters to look at solutions.
And is the registration for the conference still open, or have you capped out at 500 or so participants?
No, it's online. We're geared up. We have extra facilitators in the wings, and we're wide open to all of our Vermonters. To register, all you have to do is go to www.futureofvermont.org, and it's all right there in front of you. And again, I think all sorts of Vermonters from all parts of the state will be engaged in these sessions, and it should be a fascinating discussion of the big picture of the future and how we can line up together, especially after COVID and especially after all the political division we've faced. You know, what can bring us together, and how do we line up for action?
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, it sounds interesting. And I am registered, so I'll see you there for sure.
Good.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there for today, folks. But I wanted to thank all of our panelists today. Andy Keeler of the Jasper Hill Farm in Greensboro, Charlie Hancock of the Northwoods Forestry in Montgomery, and, of course, Paul Costello, the executive director of the Vermont Council on Rural Development, who's the reason we're all here in the first place. So that's been kudos to you, Paul. Great job on this. And I want to thank all of you for being with us today. Hope you found the program interesting. And hopefully we'll see you again next week, when we'll be taking up the final proposition in this 10-part series. That reads, together, Vermonters must renew civic engagement and strengthen trust, civility, and democratic decision-making, and empower young Vermonters. So that should be an interesting subject. Lots to talk about there, no doubt about it. We'll be bringing that one to you next week. And again, definitely, I think it's going to be worth tuning in for. So again, thanks to all of our panelists. Thank you for being with us. And we'll see you again the next time.
You have been listening to Ideas for the Future of Vermont, a podcast produced by GNAT TV and the Vermont Council on Rural Development. Thank you for listening local.